Yes, I am the world. I'm John Batchelor. Interventionism. It is a negative. So let's go to the larger picture of business in the world of geopolitics. I welcome Jan Petrovsky, the business editor of The Economist magazine, for a special edition in The Economist I recommend for people running businesses in the United States, listening to us internationally, and at the same time, imagining what is changing when we see the People's Republic of China talk about state-supported enterprises versus private enterprises. When we see in the United States, for example, the Biden administration talk about antitrust or labor protection, and especially when we see the EU speculating on international taxes, not just where you have your headquarters or where your labor where your labor force is, but something uniform around the world. Jan, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this. This is the big concept of the future, but I want to start in the present. This debate about governments intervening, what is driving it? Is it the pandemic, or was it here before the pandemic? Good evening to you.
Good evening. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. So I think there are several forces. The big factors that are driving what I identify as this current wave of turbocharged state intervention in business. Some of it dates back to the financial crisis, when a lot of ordinary people and their elected representatives, or indeed in China's case, unelected representatives, got the sense that the capitalism as it was functioning, the sort of highly global capitalist system, was leaving too many people behind, and it wasn't working for ordinary folks. So that was definitely, and since then, in the past 12 years, the issue of income inequality, the issue of stagnating living standards has been something that a lot of politicians have used in their rhetoric. It is something that a lot of ordinary citizens have worried about deeply. So that's been around for a while. In the past few years, a few additional factors, a confluence of a few additional factors appeared, which I think really strengthened the government's desire to take a more hands-on approach to business. One of them is the reemergence of this grand geopolitical contest between China and the West, which has sort of been dormant ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union. So geopolitics really was on the back burner. Nobody cared too much about it. It wasn't a big global concern, either for governments or for businesses. The second thing that's changed is a real acknowledgement that climate change is a big problem that needs to be faced up to, and that only governments have the sort of the wherewithal, organizational, coordinative, and financial, to do something about it. And the third is indeed the pandemic. The pandemic really showed that governments, every now and again, they are the only ones that can step in and you know, help solve problems which the private sector is ill-equipped to tackle. And I think those things happening are now sort of compounding each other and happening at once and leading to a surge of activity on the part of governments, which we haven't seen in quite a long time.
You report accurately that this is peak capitalism right now. The profits are soaring. The markets are healthy despite the pandemic, perhaps in spite of everything. The markets are soaring, and there looks to be, as you report, a uniform understanding that maybe we've gone too far, maybe things can be done, a correction. Now, the question is this about capitalism? Is this about the way capitalism conducts itself outside of its own borders? You call upon Chief Executive Jamie Dimon, who was always commenting during the financial crisis, and now, 10 years later, same man commenting. Does he believe that capitalism needs a polish, some reorganizing by itself, or does he welcome state conversation?
Well, I haven't actually spoken to him, so he's cited from his public utterances, and he has been quite vocal about the need to, you know, maybe not rethink capitalism completely, but to, as you say, to, you know, to at least to tweak it a little bit, because it does not appear to be working. for many people. And that's certainly the sentiment that a lot of people have, that it isn't working. But I mean, if you look at it from a historical perspective, that capitalism is always evolving, right? I mean, it's never a static thing. And in fact, the one thing that I really took to heart from my research into this report is that the sort of thing that we're seeing now is not, it's not the first time that governments have had this sort of reaction. So, you know, after the Second World War, which was another crisis moment, I mean, the Second World War obviously itself followed the Depression, which was another crisis moment, you had governments feeling much more empowered to boss business around, because it was felt that only governments had the legitimacy, only governments had the resources to rebuild whole economies and whole bodies politic after a big, you know, disaster that was the Second World War. So you know, we've seen this before. This reflex is not entirely new. I think the interesting thing about what's happening now is that it is happening simultaneously just about everywhere in the world. So whereas in the aftermath of the Second World War, you had, you know, different countries experimenting with different flavors of this, of social market economy, especially in Europe, you actually had a big, pretty big expansion of the regulatory state in America. You never had public ownership in America to a large extent, but you did have, you know, all the regulatory agencies being brought into being. In Europe, you had dirigisme in France. I mean, dirigisme is a French word, after all. You know, in Germany, you had the social market economy. Italy and Britain had their own versions of this, you know, with a huge nationalization drive in Britain after the Second World War. So, but they never quite happened at exactly the same time. These phenomena overlapped, these trends overlapped, but they never crested at quite the same time. So by the time that Europeans were still deeply involved in state support for industry, and Japan was becoming a powerful force, it was thought, partly thanks to state support of its industrial champions in the sort of late early 1980s. In Britain, you already, and in America, in Britain under Thatcher and America under Reagan, you're already seeing signs of a backlash against it. So it never quite coincided. Now, probably as a result of globalization, where, you know, everything travels around the world much more quickly than it used to, as a result of an exchange of ideas and information, which is much more rapid, and as a result of a much more globalized economy, in which if one country does something, then other countries which trade with it, you know, often follow suit, because they feel if they don't, they will be left behind. You have a situation where many places, and especially the world's biggest markets, America, Europe, and China, are reaching for very similar tools at exactly the same time.
We go to where the serious money spends its time, taxes. Just momentarily now, you have some statistics that are stark. Companies that have 5% of their workforce in one particular place, a country, wind up paying taxes, 67% of their taxes. Why? Because companies have learned to move their tax base to where they're treated best. There is a remedy for this proposed by the OECD and others, chiefly the Treasury Secretary of the United States, Janet Yellen, to make a global tax, a uniform global corporate tax. You have a quote from an observer saying this will be messy. Where is that process, Jan? Has it advanced more than the proposal state?
Oh, no, it's basically been agreed upon by over 130 countries have signed on to this idea. It has not yet been enacted. I think the OECD hopes that the deal will be signed at some point this year, probably about around mid-year, and then that it will come into force starting in 2023. I think that's the desired timeline. Obviously, you know, reality can intervene and things can change. But it seems like it's not inconceivable that this sort of thing, or, you know, that the pact will be enacted this year and begin to be implemented next year.
Yes, you're right that one guarantee here is that it'll be good for tax lawyers and accountants. I observe that irony is a commonplace. However, is this more important than the other pieces that you look at when you consider what you report as a chill is in the air? Is it taxes that's going to bite in the hardest?
Probably not, actually, to be perfectly honest. I think on taxes, I mean, the current regime is 100 years old. It was basically, you know, brought into being in the 1920s when the world economy was very different, when companies were very different, when you had barely any multinationals and the multinationals were much less global than they are today. And that system has shown its age. So I don't think there's necessarily a problem with trying to rethink it. I mean, I don't have a very strong opinion on the OECD pact, and, you know, I'm not a tax expert. What I know is that it will have an impact. I don't think it will raise an awful lot of extra revenue. I mean, the estimates I've seen from people who are experts on the issue is something like 4% more tax from corporations relative to what they're paying today, which is, you know, on the margin it matters, but it's not, you know, it's not a huge wad of cash. I think what is more interesting and more important is that especially those large companies which have really tightly optimized their operations to the current regime will now have to start thinking about to re-optimize them for the new regime. And that is going to be very messy. That's, I think, what the executive I spoke to was referring to.
I'm speaking to Jan Petrosky. He is the business editor of The Economist magazine, a special issue about, well, The Economist always has a wry way of putting things, bossy states, you know, bossy governments, bossy geopolitical contests. We're going to turn to the bossiness next when it comes to regulations, the favorite dance in the United States. Well, it turns out it's a favorite dance in Europe and Britain and China as well. What does the future hold? I'm John Bash.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.